break it and you break it and you, oh baby, swing it and you sing it and you, oh baby, knock it and you rock it and you, oh baby, skip it and you dip it and you, oh baby, the world seems upside down when you holler, oh baby.
Welcome again to the lovely Pirate Monk podcast.
The lovely Pirate Monk podcast.
It's lovely today.
Okay.
Today is a lovely day. It is, again, Monday, so this is the day that we record the Pirate Monk podcast. And I'm your host, David Mullen, along with our fearless leader, Nate Larkin. And we are...
Neither fearless nor leader.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you got to say what you got to say. Keep these things moving.
Right.
But what happened at the meeting last week? What did y'all discuss?
Oh, that's a very, you know, we had a great meeting, big meeting. First of the year. It's kind of like going to the gym at the first of the year.
Or church.
The place is busy. Yeah.
Joint is jumping.
That's right. So
everybody's ready to get into recovery.
The room was full on Monday night, and we had a great time. Topic was intimacy.
Intimacy.
Which led to some great sharing in our group.
Mm.
What was the
overall writing thing? You know how sometimes like it'll just take on a flavor of its own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how it went in the other groups. I know that in the group, the sharing group that I was in, you know, we kind of came down to the simple fact that intimacy is something we desperately need, something that many of us are deeply afraid of.
Mm.
I learned early on in recovery. I was surprised to learn early on in recovery that my sex addiction was actually an intimacy disorder.
Mm. Mm.
I long for intimacy and fear it, and at some point confused sex with intimacy.
Mm.
I know from experience that they're not the same. Because I have been intimate with hundreds of strangers without being intimate.
Right.
In fact, those engagements actually drove me farther from myself and from God, deeper into isolation.
Mm.
I settled for false intimacy and lust killed love, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Really destroyed for a long time, just destroyed my capacity for real friendship. So now, in recovery, I'm learning how to be emotionally present with another person, how to share my real self.
Mm.
How to listen, how to give. And I'm finding that that non-sexual intimacy is, first of all, it's the foundation for real sexual intimacy.
Mm.
It's deeply satisfying all by itself. So anyway, that's where it went in our group. We had a... We had a great discussion.
You know what that always reminds me of? It's that we're hungry. You know?
Yeah.
So we want, instead of getting good, healthy food that will sate us and that will actually make us grow and that sort of thing, keep us healthy, we prefer cakes and candy and stuff like that. It always makes me think of Edmund in the... in the C.S. Lewis Narnia tales, you know, where he goes to the Ice Queens, the sort of the personification, I guess, of Satan, if you will, you know, and evil. And she offers him Turkish Delight.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts eating the Turkish Delight because he is hungry because he's been wandering around for 2 days without any food.
Mm-hmm.
So he eats it. But it's also his favorite treat. So instead of eating what's good for him, he's eating the treat, and he keeps eating it, and he knows he's getting sicker and sicker, but he just keeps eating the Turkish Delight.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then basically in the end, he gives up Aslan, he gives up his sisters and his brothers,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
For Turkish Delight, which he can't even stand anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and that is such a good picture of what we're talking about here in intimacy. Is what we are made for. Relationship is what we are created for.
Yeah.
The whole reason God made us was to be in relationship with Him.
Yeah.
And he said that that was good.
Yeah.
That was a good thing. And then we can't make things that last forever, like eternal things, but we can make things that last a long time. So we can make friendships that last a long time. Mm-hmm. So I think we should mimic him in that. And those that kind of stuff, that kind of intimacy is really what we long for, but we'll settle for a quickie at the, you know.
And this is where pornography is pernicious, mm-hmm. and where a commercial sex is pernicious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a young man, I longed for intimacy, but feared it. I feared rejection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a, you're really laying yourself out there to show yourself to another person, and they might react with indifference or hostility or whatever. So pornography and commercial sex offer what appears to be risk-free intimacy.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you confuse intimacy with sex.
But you'll always end up leaving the things you really want.
Right.
Settling for less than you should have. Making friends with the ice queen and leaving your brothers and sisters behind.
That's how it works.
Welcome back to the Pirate Monk Podcast. I'm David Mullen, your host, with Nate Larkin, our lovely engineer.
Why is everything
lovely
today?
Lovely. It's a lovely Monday. I have lots of caffeine.
All right.
And
okay.
It's lovely. And our lovely engineer Mondo is at the controls today. As always, during this section, we'd like to bring you letters, people who are writing us at letters@samsonsociety.org. If you have a question, if you have a suggestion, if you'd like us to answer some question, or you just want to like make comments and you'd like to add in to things that we've already said, we'd love to hear from you. Again, that's letters@samsonsociety.org. Got any letters, Nate?
Well, you know,
I would think, salty dog that you are, we've got a lot because you were cussing all over the podcast last week.
Okay. Oh, my. You know, and we got no letters of complaint.
Good.
I think I did. You bleeped me, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, very good.
Oh, yeah. You have no idea how much we bleeped you.
We got a number of great letters this week. In fact, more than we can answer today. There's a couple I'd like to go in, maybe on the next podcast we go deeper. We've got a special guest today we want to give special a lot of time to. But here's, I've picked out three.
Okay.
Got a letter from Bert Foster with a song suggestion. He says, don't know if you've heard it yet. I'm sure you have, because after all, we are the...
the guys who know all the music.
Right, yeah. Well, you are. But there's an amazing song by Voda called Honestly, that could have been written as a theme song for Samson. Here are the lyrics, in case you've never heard them. Have you heard this, David?
I have heard it.
Read you just a little bit of it. Honestly, can I tell you where I am? Honestly, can I tell you where I'm at? Honestly, can I pull the curtain back? Will you run if you see how weak I am?
Mm.
If you don't see the real me, you won't see what mercy's done. If you don't see my weakness, you won't see what love has won.
Mm.
If you don't see the distance from the darkness to the sun,
you
won't see honestly.
Yeah. There you
That's
go.
Awesome. That's can you dig that one up?
We'll play. I think I can. I think right. I can. Anything else we got in there today?
Sure. Got a question here from Chip in Ocala, Florida.
Chip.
Yeah, or Orlando.
Chip. Oh, Orlando.
Chip Shepherd.
Well,
he and
close.
I actually go way back.
Oh.
Good friend. Chip says, thank you so much for the podcast. I look forward to each one. Such a great resource as a supplement to my recovery. Any suggestions for daily devotionals geared toward recovery?
Yeah, I can think of a few. How about you? Huh?
Yeah, yeah. You know what? The one that I like, the new one, actually, I think it's a reissue of one that was done in the early 90s. Stephen Arterburg and David Stoop have put out something called the Life Recovery Devotional.
Oh yeah,
it's based on 12-step recovery, 30 devotionals for each of the 12 steps.
Right.
So you've got something to do every day.
Right.
And then for your own Bible reading, a kind of a companion to that is the Life Recovery Bible.
Right.
It's not a study Bible, but it's a great devotional Bible. It's New Living Translation, easy to read.
Sure, and if you're going to be doing the disciplines of prayer and study, then this makes it kind of easy and prepackaged, and you just...
And I've also found that there are dozens, probably hundreds of places online where a guy can find a daily recovery reading. I've got one. I'm not even going to try and read the URL because it's about a mile long. But I've got it set up in my bookmarks.
Okay.
And I just click on that each morning, and it's a I can read the whole they draw from a bunch of recovery sources.
So it's like an RSS feed.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I could just read a bunch of stuff each day. Real important, it's that energy bar, that you know, just a little bit of healthy intake.
Right, a little healthy intake. And spending that time in meditation, once again, I can't emphasize that enough. You know, just the time that you spend there sitting down and thinking about what you have read, you know what I mean, is really important. Don't just go through stuff and check it off. Mine are similar. The NIV Recovery Bible is just great. It's a day-to-day thing, daily readings, daily portions, and pointing out the things that are like answering the negative things that are going on that are making you angry, sad, mad, or afraid, and then the keep it simply, keep it simple daily meditation, which is sort of a similar thing to what you were talking about, but it's put out by 12 Steps.
Okay,
and but it's just reminding you just.
Yeah,
keep just a little prayer.
Yeah,
a little time with the Lord.
Yeah,
a little meditation.
Is that a Hazleton? I think it might be.
Yeah, it is a Hazleton book. And then, but most of all, is a book. It's not really a devotional book, but it's we keep mentioning it here on the podcast. And I cannot recommend it highly enough. And it's Gary Thomas's Sacred Marriage. And there's all kinds of a participant's guide. Sacred Marriage, there's a daily devotional Sacred Marriage, there's the book itself, Sacred Marriage, but my point being that a lot of these things are triggered by bad relationships, as you were saying before, and that number one bad relationships a lot of times is that marital relationship, and when he asks the question and flips your whole thinking about relationships on its head and says, what if marriages were about being holy and not just being happy? Mm-hmm. What if the whole point of the person pissing you off and like setting you off and pushing your buttons and the whole nine yards was that God wanted them to so that you could work that crap out of you so that you really truly could become more like Jesus. You could become more holy. And in that sense, it really is. It's a daily thing. It's a and the ones that do have like the marriage participation guide for sacred marriage is really, really good. And it's something you can work through on your own or you can work through as a couple. So those are our... those are our suggestions for devotional type books. And didn't you have one more from a friend out in Oregon?
Yeah, I got a letter here from an old friend, Darren Muir, who we met on the Samson road cruise.
Oh yeah,
two summers ago when we went through Medford, Oregon.
Road trip, road trip. Yep.
So great to hear from Darren again. Hi Nate, just wanted to shoot you a quick note. Let you know how much the Samson Society podcasts have blessed me. Every episode has managed to challenge me in at least one area while keeping me entertained with the personal anecdotes. Thanks for the extra work you're putting in on this. Sorry I can't make it down to the 48 Hours of Frankness event in Central California. By the way,
that thing is sold out.
Gone.
That's right.
Sold out last week, moved it to a bigger camp, sold out again. We're out of camps.
120 people, got a waiting list.
All right.
So, sorry.
But just to keep you up to date, Darren says, God led Denise and I, that's his wife, to leave our old church to help plant a new church here in town, which led to starting a new Samson group with some of the guys there. The original group at my old church is still going strong, so now there are three Samson meetings that I know of available to the men in our area. Praise God for what he's doing in the lives of men. Thank you again for being obedient enough to be used by God to help radically change my life. Great to hear from Darren. And great to hear that we've got three functioning Samson meetings in Medford, Oregon.
Yeah, Oregon seems to be the topic of the day, as it were. Our special guest
is out in Portland. We're gonna in just a minute. We're gonna make a call to Paul Young. Check in on the author of The Shack.
That's right. And of course, to all of us, that would be William P. Young. But you know, when you're really good friends with him, you call him Paul, I guess. So. Hey, let's listen to a little bit of that Voda song, and we'll be right back with William P. Young on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Honestly, can I tell you where I'm at? Honestly, can I pull the curtain back?
Hey, Paul. Nate Larkin here.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very well. Chewing on my breakfast.
Well, thank you so much for taking our call. I'm here with David Mullen.
How you doing?
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks.
Good. Thanks for letting me do this. This is great.
We're glad that you will do it.
Well, Paul, I don't know that you really need much of an introduction to our listeners. I think they'd probably have to be living on Mars not to have heard of The Shack.
Oh, thanks. Although I've heard that it hasn't been translated into Martian yet. So.
Oh. not yet.
Yeah. Now, have you got foreign language translations out?
We've got about 30, and I guess there's an intention is about 46.
Wow. Any truth to the rumors of a film?
Yeah, there are truths to the rumors. And I'm actually working on writing the screenplay right now, and nothing really is going to move until that's done.
Wow.
So it's there. You know, it's, again, one of those things where you want to be involved in something God is blessing rather than trying to convince him that this is such a great idea, you know?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, early mid in for the soundtrack. So. Shameless plug. Okay.
Not a problem. I'm kind of used to it.
Well, as remarkable as the book is, Paul, even more remarkable in my mind is the story behind it. What led to your writing of the book, and then behind that story, what God did to make you into the man who would write the book.
Thank you for that. And, you know, everything comes out of somewhere, and part of the beauty of a God who is a relational being is that, pardon me, I forgot to turn off my phone here. We'll get it. There we go. And part of the beauty of a God who's a relational being is that participation becomes a key word. You know, union is a key word, and participation is a key word. And, you know, we all participate. God, I don't know if you've noticed, but God just doesn't come in and change you and make you think right and make you do the right things and make him. He makes it for you. I mean, as much as you'd wish he would do that, he just doesn't do that. I think he respects the creation so much that he will not violate it, but rather within love will grow it into a participation. So all of us participate in our own healing. All of us participate. You know, in writing the book, I tell people, you know, I didn't write it by myself, but God didn't write it by himself either. And the flawed parts, those are mine, but it's part of participation. You know, when we write song, creative stuff, loving our children, growing in grace, the process of healing, it's part of relationship and participation.
Mm. So true. Now, you wrote this book. Let's start with just the writing the book. You wrote the book in 2005.
And it got published in 07, in May of 07. But in 2005, all I was trying to do is get it done for Christmas. I have six children. My youngest is 16, my oldest is 29. And trying to get it done for Christmas. So the first and only intended run was 15 copies at Office Depot in a little town of Gresham, Oregon. And the book did everything that I wanted it to do. You know, I've always written as gifts, so this was just a gift for my kids for Christmas. I was working three jobs at the time and went back to my jobs, no big deal. And my friends kept giving it away. That was the problem. So that started a conversation. Some folks got involved. 26 publishers turned it down. A couple friends created a publishing company. We pooled our resources. I had a friend who would loan me money, and the other two guys were some savings, and the other one had a Visa and MasterCard. So, I mean, the whole thing is a God story. There's just, you know, the first 13 months out of a garage in Los Angeles, we shipped over 1 million books and spent less than $300 in marketing and advertising. I mean, there's just no way you can be that brilliant. I mean, it's not possible. So whatever, you know, whatever purposes God has around the things that we do, we just don't. Yeah, we don't have a clue. Not really.
Now, Paul, you spent your early life on the mission field. You grew up in a Christian family, and that kind of set the stage. You were on a trajectory toward professional ministry. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, missionary kid and then a preacher's kid, because he came back from the mission field around when I was around 10 years old, and then my father was an itinerant preacher. Mission field, I was 10 months old, so this was my first, it's my first family, it's my first frame of reference, and it was among the tribal people in the highlands, and spirit worshiping, warrior, Stone Age technology cannibals, and with a very intricate societal customs and relationships, and but they were my family. That's who I grew up with. That's my parents were part of a generation where, you know, they were told if you do the work of God, God will take care of the details, and children are part of the details. And so they just believed that if they let the tribal people raise me, that everything would be fine, that God would take care of that. And so I was very disconnected from my parents. And my father was a very angry man anyway. He brought a significant amount of baggage from his own history and basically just dumped it on me. I don't think intentionally. He was young. He wasn't that mature of a believer. He had not been a believer for that many years, probably, I'd say by then, maybe 6 or 7. But here he is dropped into the middle of a culture that had never seen white people. Nobody knew the language. I was the first person who ever learned the language in that area. I was the informant when I was 5 years old for Wycliffe when they came in to translate. So very stark distinction between my parents' experience and mine. And my dad was a very harsh disciplinarian. I think that's the kindest way to put it. And the tribal people whom I loved, if you'd asked me anywhere during my history to draw a circle around my family, and my parents would have been on that chart, and the Dani people, the tribal people, were, I would have drawn it around the tribal people. There was just no question. But they were also the first sexual abusers. And whether it was endemic to their culture or whether it seemed, you know, in retrospect, as I thought about this a lot, that a lot of it had to do with the fact that I was special, that I was white. And when they talked about whether or not to kill my parents or not in conversations that I was around, it was that I was never going to be harmed. I was trouble people, not a big deal. And ultimately, they didn't choose to kill my parents. They rather decided to steal everything they could because my parents brought in steel axes, for one thing. And, you know, their bamboo knives are way sharper than steel, but axes, that's another thing. They use stone axes, and so that became a very a huge thing to rip off. They later returned them when the gospel penetrated their hearts. But during my early childhood, sexual abuse probably started about 4 or 4.5, and kind of became one of those building blocks of the shack and the house of the soul. You know, that many of us, we don't have a very, very nice, presentable house on the inside. It's just a house full of damage and pain and shame, and it's where we hide all our secrets and our addictions, and our lies are permeated from there. And so sexual abuse, I went to boarding school at 6, and sexual abuse continued from older peers. And so, you know, it's the kind of junk that some of us carry into our adulthood, and then we drag it into our marriages, and we drag it into our relationships, and we're hoping that maybe if we can just stay in secret, you know, keep it hidden, that and pursue God, and maybe God will heal us apart from exposure. That is, you know, when my addictions are hidden, maybe God will heal me in that hidden place so that I don't have to deal with it in any kind of public sense.
Yeah, boy, do I know that. For years, crying out to God for a private solution to my private problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We are as sick as secrets we keep. You know, and there's reasons why we keep secrets. You know, as we grow up, we develop ways of staying safe, you know, especially, it depends on the kind of experience you have. And one thing I want to say is you can't compare your pain with anybody else's. You just can't do it. Every person is an absolute unique creation, and it's an incredibly intricate creation. And every person is damaged uniquely. And we know this. You can put 10 kids in front of the same abuse, and you'll have 10 lives go 10 totally different directions in terms of how they deal with it or respond to it. And so you can't compare your healing either. So you can't compare your pain and your baggage. And a lot of, especially Christians, they'll say, well, I didn't go what that person went through. And they minimize and, in a sense, dismiss the damage that's in their own hearts because, you know, we have a scale of intensity or something, and mine's not as bad as somebody else's, so why should I even deal with mine? And it's another form of staying hidden, but it's we're even ashamed that we didn't get hurt as badly as somebody else, you know?
I mean, oh, isn't that true?
No, it's ridiculous, but it's true. And And we don't want to be embarrassed. I think that's probably the biggest fear in this culture is embarrassment. Easy to see if you ask, if you're in, especially within a Christian group, and you see, what was Jesus meaning by this passage? Nobody wants to say anything because they're afraid of being wrong. And it's just this embarrassment thing. And so we hide, you know, and we find lots of different ways to hide. But I use the shack as a metaphor for the house that people help us build on the inside, where we hide all our stuff. And
yeah, and meanwhile, we construct something that, that the public, that the world will see, what Susan Howitch calls the glittering image, right?
I call that the facade on the outside. So yeah, I don't want you to see my shack, but what I'll do is I'll create a facade, you know, like those quarter-inch plywood buildings in the sets of the Hollywood movies. You know, there's no substance, but there's appearance. And so I create a facade outside the shack. And the beauty of a quarter-inch piece of plywood is that if I can pick up your expectations, I can paint it to match them as best I can. And if I'm really good at it, then I'll win some of your approval and some of your affection. But the damage of secrets is that we're terrified if somebody finds out what's really there, that we will lose all the affection and the approval that we've managed to scrabble together. But the flip side is that when we get approval and affection, we don't believe it. We don't trust it. We don't embrace it simply because they don't know the secret. So they're giving their approval and their affection to the facade, not to the reality of who I am. So we're stuck. We can't tell our secrets because we're terrified, but we won't embrace love and affection and approval because they don't know the truth. And it's a horrible trap that secrets put us in. And you know, a lot of we've got good reason to hold on to our secrets, and we've got good reason to hold on to our safety mechanisms and the things that we developed as children in order to stay alive. Those things which prevent us from embracing relationship later in life. But, I mean, they saved us. I mean, it's so difficult to think that I've got to give up the systems that protected me in order that I can truly move into relationship, both with God and with other people. And but we have to. At some point, those things have got to come down, and the facade's got to come down. And unfortunately, for a lot of us, especially I think men, we don't just snap into a place where we say, "Yeah, you know what? I'm so screwed up. I'm going to go get some help." Normally, we have to be caught, and that's a terrifying process that is that I've been through, because I didn't go find help. I just hid everything from my wife Kim and everybody else. And I lived with Kim for a long time before everything crashed and burned. And
yes,
I talk about.
Yes. So you were married, kids, in ministry, and at that point the facade came down?
Yeah, ministry in the sense that anybody is. You know, I was only on professional staff for about a couple of years way back in the late 70s, working with college kids. And other than that, I've always held secular jobs and did stuff on the side, did a lot of teaching on the side. And so 38 years old, I talk about Mackenzie's weekend in the shack as representing my 11 years. It started January 4th, 94, and that's when I got the phone call from Kim. And she just said, you know, I'm waiting at your office, and I know. That's all she said. And my entire facade came down. I put like a thin layer of perfectionist performance covering up this ocean of shame. And that just blew the little facade to pieces, because what she knew was that I was in a 3-month affair with one of her best friends at the time. And so, you know, do is you try to justify your behavior, because, you know, even though the facade's out there, the addictions and everything else are running, they continue to exist. And you're crying out to God, you know, please heal me. But you don't want him to do it in any sort of public way. You don't want to have to be exposed. You don't want to have those conversations where you say, you know what, I'm not the perfect person that I've been trying to portray. In fact, I'm far from it. And getting caught, you know, it just suddenly everything becomes clear. During the affair, I borderlined moving into some form of insanity. You know, you You have to, if you can't justify your behavior with the facade you've created, you've got to change reality. So, I mean, I even thought Kim was going to die in order that this relationship, this affair would be facilitated. That's how sick it was. And, you know, for a lot of us, I think that affairs, especially we've got certain kinds of damage in our history, I think the affair is an illusion of being loved unconditionally, which on the face of it is absolutely not true, because if the person truly loves me, they wouldn't damage my marriage or any of those things, and I wouldn't damage theirs. The romanticist facade that finally I can just be myself, and all the effort and all the energy that takes to cover up all my crap, I don't need in this relationship. It's totally a lie. And so, I had to decide whether to kill myself or not, because those are the only two options that I felt I had when the facade came down. I had to either face my wife or kill myself. And frankly, I don't even know how I made it driving across town and pulled into my office where Kim had already torn the place to shreds. You'd love Kim. She is, part of what saved me was her fury. Her fury pushed me to deal with every piece of crap in my history. So, I walked after the first 45 to hour barrage. I said, look, if we're going to do this, I have to tell you every secret that I have. I mean, and we can't do this privately. I've got to tell you it all. It took 4 days to tell her all my stuff, and it destroyed her. I mean, she was devastated. At the end of those 4 days, she said, I'll never believe another thing that comes out of your mouth the rest of your life. And I believed her. And so I went into counseling right away with a group, met a guy named Scott Mitchell, who became a good friend, and didn't know him from anybody. But it's a group that specialized in sexual abuse histories. And I sat in front of him the first day and said, Scott, my life as I've known it is over. I mean, it's gone. And I don't even know anymore how to get to point B, let alone all the way to Z. For the first time in my life, I said these words, can you help me? I said those words to another human being. Can you? And he said, yeah. And I said, look, the last thing I need is somebody to ask me how I feel about stuff. You know, I need somebody who knows how to get me from here down the road. And he said, yeah, I can do that, but it'll take a year and a half. And I said, good, I'm in. He said, right. Everybody who says that, who sits in your chair, they always say they're in. But after a couple months, you'll feel a little more in control. Things are going to be a little better. And you'll bail out, you know. And I said, look, I won't leave this process until you tell me I'm done. This had been such a devastating thing. And Kim continued to pound on me every day. And then when I would call her about my times with Scott, because I was telling her everything. So I would tell her, and she said the same thing every day. Yeah, right, whatever. I mean, she didn't believe it. And I thought, you know what, it's going to be this way the rest of my life. She is not going to believe anything anymore. And she has every right not to. I spent 9 months with Scott, and then he said, you know what, you're done. You've accomplished everything that we set out to do. And he said, we've never had anybody stay with the process and hang in there and work this hard. And I did, because you know what? If I couldn't find some healing, this was it. I mean, I was done. Because my whole life was, I look down that hole of all my history and I'm thinking, what's been real? I don't know anything that's truly real from the time I was a child. What am I supposed to do? Go back to before I'm 4 years old and figure out something that's real? And if I couldn't find some healing, what's the point? I've just continued to spew pain on everybody in my history and in my life. And I even got to the place during the process with Scott, because he said, everybody bails out right before the really hard stuff. Well, I stayed through the really hard stuff. And in the middle of that, I lost all my hope. I thought, there's no way. And I'm planning how to fly to Mexico because I don't want my kids to find my body, you know. And a friend spoke into my heart. And when I was saying, you know, I'm just a piece of crap. And I'm just all dried up and the wind's blowing me apart. And she says, Paul, there's a seed in there. And I'm thinking, a seed? And then I start thinking, you know, if there's just a seed, I don't know what could grow, but if there were a seed, something real could grow. And in that seed, all my hope came back. One little tiny seed. And then I'm thinking, you know, seeds, they grow good in this kind of stuff, you know? And all my hope came back. It was the last time in my life. That conversation was the last time in my life I was suicidal. And because of one little seed. And you know what? There's a seed in there. And I don't care how much damage history in your past and what kind of lies you've expressed and lived and what kind of damage you've done to others, you know. There's a seed. That's something God planted a long time ago. And regardless of how much crap has been piled on top of it, it's there. And just has to be called to life. And the only person I know who can do that is God, but it does it in the context of community and the context of openness, in the context of telling our stories and risking, all of those things.
Mm. So, Paul, I'm just so moved by your story. I see the redeeming hand of God pushing you out of this shame-bound isolation toward community, giving you trustworthy people.
And by the way, a couple of years ago, in a circle of people who knew my history, Kim says to them in front of me, she says, you know, I never thought I would ever say this in my life, but it was all worth it. And she wasn't saying, you know, oh, look what God can do out of damage, therefore the damage is some part of his plan. Nah, God's not the creator of evil. What he's saying is that there's nothing so lost that God can't find it. There's nothing so broken he can't heal it. There's nothing so dead that he can't bring life out of it. And she and I, Kim and I, are the best we've ever been. I mean, the forgiveness is absolutely, completely concluded. And
the wound is healed?
The wound is healed, absolutely. Mm.
It's David, Paul. What does your sobriety look like these days? I mean, what's a day? How do you maintain? What's that looking like for you these days?
Well, see, I love what AA does. I love what they really, I believe, are something, and what you folks are involved in and all that. There is a point where I believe that God heals, not just teaches us coping mechanisms. I'm not saying that that's what you guys do, but to a degree, you know, people maintain an identity as a broken person. You know, when you say, I'm an alcoholic, but I've been clean for X amount of years, as beautiful as that is, there is a subtle issue of identity that is, to me, not correct. You know, you once were. And I believe that God heals, not just helps us to cope. But that has a way more theological underpinnings in that statement than we have time for. But there's an issue of identity for us. And so how do I cope? One is, in this process, there has been healing for the kinds of addictions I have, pornography and all that. You know, that's just one thing that has no attraction for me. If I accidentally run into it, my immediate thought is for the humanity of that person. Because pornography, when it's an addiction, it's not about the picture or what you see or the person. It's about you. It's all about me in the middle of the addiction. It's not about that person. And it's about the imagination of either power or someone loving us. And if the way we were communicated affection as it was as a child was through sexual means, then there's a trigger there. And so, you know, the addiction is all about me. In the healing, it's no longer about me. It becomes the compassion for that person and who's represented in that image or whatever. And so it really does not have an attraction for me at all. I mean, if I let it, I'm sure that it could become an addiction again. There's really strong guards in my own heart. And the other thing, too, is that, you know, I have no secrets. And I'm not even addicted to pleasing my dad anymore. I mean, and that was a huge one. Or addicted to doing something significant for God or, you know, having a ministry or something. You know, all of those addictions that are gold chain addictions, you know, much more acceptable inside a performance-based culture or Christian subculture. And so, you know, I've got an open life. I have no secrets. I mean, there is nothing that Kim doesn't know. There is nothing my kids don't know, or my friends, and or the public even. And so that's a guard. You know, I don't have an accountability group or anything like that at this point. My accountability group at one time was Scott Mitchell, who was the counselor, and that I was telling Kim everything, regardless of her response. And there's a funny scene in the shack where we're near the end where Papa calls Mackenzie a liar. I don't know if you remember that, but Papa says, you know, why is it, you know, why didn't you tell Nan, his wife? And of course he says, you know, I didn't want to hurt her. And she says, you're such a liar. You know, it was all about you. You didn't want to have to deal with her response. You didn't want to have to deal with her emotions. And, you know, so you covered up by justifying it and putting it in really sweet language, like I didn't want her to feel more pain, you know. I'm protecting her or whatever. And basically God is saying, you know, that's BS. You're just covering up the fact that you're afraid of emotions and you're afraid of relationship. And that's right out of my life, you know. The way we justify ourselves is how, that's our salvation. That's how we think about our salvation, is how we justify ourselves. And me, I don't have the secrets, which is a huge amount of.
Yeah, and most of us have not felt that freedom in a minute.
Yeah, a minute can be a long time. Just ask the Green Bay Packers.
Yes! I was very happy yesterday. Very happy.
That was a great game. Let me tell you, I haven't seen that much offense in I don't know how long.
I know. It was like 100 points, right?
Yeah.
Right about 100 points. But and
almost 1,000 yards. In fact, it might have been
over. Yeah, it was over. It was 1,000, almost 1,100 yards.
Wow. Unbelievable.
I cannot believe that's the Sunday I chose to take a nap.
What do you mean you choose every Sunday to take a nap?
I love naps, too. So I just happen to be working on stuff and watching it on my screen over here.
That's good.
That's how you do it.
Well, Paul, thank you so very much for sharing your story, for modeling authenticity, for giving hope. Let me just ask you one last question. To the listener out there to the Samson Society podcast who is just on the very front edge of recovery, of getting honest. Maybe they haven't even jumped from the high dive yet. They're standing at the end of the board looking at how far down it is, wondering if they'll survive. What's your message to that person?
One is, if you don't make some choices for change, nothing will change. Get worse. You know, it's not like if we just hang around waiting long enough, somehow something magically will get better. Because talking about is the intricacy of your own soul, your own heart that has been hurt and damaged and whatever, and out of it you've expressed more damage and hurt people. And so staying in secret and all of that, it's not going to make anything better. You can stand there on the edge for the rest of your life if you want, and I know some people have done that. But in every human being, there's a desire to become an authentic person. I think authenticity is a drive of the heart, and it's there because we're designed to be authentic and we're designed to be in relationship. God is a relational being. There's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. God has never done anything by himself, and we're created in the image of God. And, you know, for God, there's always been three. And we cannot do this apart from communities. Got to let somebody. That's the first step off the high dive is to actually let somebody in and to start this conversation somewhere, you know, with someone who you believe loves you. And then it's about taking the risks involved. You know, I absolutely believe that there's healing in the process. And that's the other thing. It takes time, and there's no formula that's going to absolutely work because no two people are the same. And so God is, he has allowed or been behind the rising of many, many different elements that he pulls together in terms of facilitating your unique healing process. And that's why you can't compare your healing with anybody else's, like you can't compare your pain with anybody else's. It's just real. Your pain is real. And it has to be exposed, and that's a scary process. It really is. It's terrifying, actually. But you can only come to healing in community. We were designed for relationship. Our pain, frankly, most of our damage comes through relationships. It's going to come through relationships, as weird as that sounds. And so the hope is there. Because I know it for myself and I know it for other people that healing is there, but it's a process, and it's a process and religion has taught us that God despises us in the process until we're perfect, and then we're acceptable and approved. Not true. You know, everything about us is in the middle of that process with us.
Mm. Paul, I watched a series of shows that they did with you. I think it was on CBN, and it's a couple, and then their children, and it's on CBN, and those were quite good. Do you know the ones I'm talking about?
I've got a clue.
Over like a 5-day period, so it was a very long time, and maybe we'll look those up online. And I just wanted people to see that because they were particularly good. I thought you elucidated very well on just your whole life and how they all kind of fit into the book you've written, and I was so impressed, and I thank you so much for being here today and just taking a half hour out of your life to spend here with us on the podcast.
Oh, no problem. I'm so honored. And you know what? Every person that's involved in this process, the value of that individual, you know, the guys standing on the edge or the guys who are in the middle of this, you know what? Your value is already there. There's nothing you have to do to earn it. That's the point. That, you know, in a world full of performance, expectation, and religions often that are full of the same kind of stuff, the real truth is that you begin valuable. You can't earn it by performing. What we're talking about is not a way to get more acclaim and acceptance and approval. We're talking about coming to healing and being authentic human beings in a world that just is shattered in its inauthenticity. And it's a beautiful journey, but it's a tough one. Mm.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for sharing yourself with us. God's taught you tons about who he is and who you are, and he's used you to teach us more of the same. Thanks, brother.
Every breath is grace. Love to be a part of it and love what you guys are doing.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, man.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Whoa, a pirate's life is a wonderful life, a roving over the sea. Give me a career as a buccaneer, it's the life of a pirate for me. Oh, the life of a pirate for me.
And we are are back at the Pirate Monk podcast. Nate, 7 million copies of this book, The Shack, have sold. 36 languages, I think it's been translated into. Has been on the New York Times bestseller list since July of 2008. I've read this book, and I will say that I don't think it really matters what you think about the story. There's people have really extreme views on this book. Like, you either love it or you hate it. You know what I mean? And for me, I think it's mainly because people think of it in terms of a salvific metaphor, if you will. You know what I mean? Instead of thinking of it in terms of recovery and redemption.
Yeah.
And that's why they're two different words for salvation and redemption. I think this is the way Paul understood his journey and what happened to him as a young boy and then as a young, even a teen, and how, you know, and how he worked through all that. And for him, I think that's why people relate to it, you know?
Yeah.
I think the reason you have 7 million people who must, you know, and they say if there's 7 million, then there's 70 million people who have read the book, probably. You know, they give it to 10 people. It's kind of the trade-off is what they're thinking, you know. Well, the reason that it's that omnipresent, that ubiquitous, if you will, you know what I mean, is because people, the problem is that widespread. Yeah. And that the language that's there is speaking to that part of people who is wounded by these sexual transgressions. Either they've committed on them on themselves, or someone has committed upon them, or they've committed upon someone else. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that that's why it speaks so deeply.
You know? I really admire, you know, Paul never had to let the public see behind the curtain,
right?
What he meant by the shack,
right.
Or he never had to give the details of his life story. But he has learned that there is freedom and authenticity, and there is bondage and secrets. Not everybody is called to tell everybody their secrets,
right.
But Paul has made this choice. I think it's a courageous and loving choice. And no matter what you think of the story, it's a modern parable that has sparked an awful lot of good conversation about
right.
the nature of God, the nature of man, the nature of evil, the reality of salvation.
The personal God.
Yeah. And, but to me, the most beautiful part of the whole story is the backstory.
That's right.
Here's a man who much of the institutional church would have relegated to perpetual, you know, would have put him outside the circle. Here's a guy who never has anything to say again. He's a sinner, and he's crossed the line. He's broken the bonds of marriage. He's an adulterer, and therefore there's never going to be a place for him, and God certainly would never use him.
Right. And which is sort of the message of
right,
religion.
Right.
You know?
And how God has worked redemptively in Paul's life, in his family, saved that marriage, pulled the family back together, and given him something to say, and a humility to speak it. So what a great privilege it was to talk to him today. Glad all those pirate monks out there got to hear a little Paul Young.
That's right. And I appreciated so much that he raised the veil, because, you know, I mean, you know, it could be so easy to be into his celebrity. He could so easily get into it, and that's our prayer for him, even as we say it, is that he will remain a man of humility and be able to show people behind the scenes what is going on in his life. I'd like to recommend, because I've watched this myself, I TiVo'd it for my mother-in-law, and I sat down and watched it, and I couldn't take my eyes off of it. And it's basically Paul's whole life story from the time he was born in, I believe, Alberta, Canada, and was raised as a missionary kid on the field, as he said, and through all the things that went through on through his life and on into riding the shack and up to last summer. So I can really recommend that, and you can find those. I think they're in podcast and video cast form at www.newday.org, or you can just YouTube it. Look for Willard Thiessen and William Paul Young on It's a New Day is what you would enter into the search field. And I can highly recommend those, and you can really get an overall view of where he's coming from. If you'd like to send us your comments, your requests about anything that we've talked about today, we'd love to hear from you. If it stirred something in your heart, if it's moving you to a different place, we want to hear about it. If there's some way we can help you, some question we can answer, we want to hear from you. And the address to do that is letters@samsonsociety.org. And again, we'd like to thank William P. Young, or Paul, as he's called to his really good friends like Nate, for being on the podcast today. And, hey, we're going to leave you here today on the Pirate Monk Podcast with a little of the British Paul Young. We'll see you next time.